Like, a lot of times people view us in a negative light because they only listen to when we're saying stop, 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 and they don't hear us actually saying go, go, go. So I wanted to get back to this abolition being a really positive, active thing to do. And it's not just this end result, because everybody says, I want abolition too, but I'm an abolitionist too, but, and they say, you're being negative and you're being negative. We're actually probably the most positive people. We believe that we are going to get there. The biggest thing I hear from people is that not that the public's not educable, it's that they don't care. They don't care. They're not going to listen to us. I disagree. And we need to be positive in our message. And somebody has said to me recently that, you know, we can talk about what we're trying to create as well as what we're trying to eliminate. Because what we're trying to create, which is a beautiful thing and a real thing and a thing that can be done, is a nonviolent, you know, human race that does not exploit each other and that does not exploit animals. That's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And the bottom line is, we can do it, but nobody's trying to do it except for us. We want more people to help us.
Well, to the extent that you hear from animal people that people don't care, that's nonsense. First of all, if that's true, what the hell are the animal people out there doing? I mean,
exactly.
I don't understand. If people don't care.
That's what I ask them. I mean, like, you know, you're out there educating people. You're doing campaigns. You've got drawings. You're saying, look at these poor faces. Look at these poor, you know, you're good at it now. You've done it for a long, long time. Why don't you just do it about veganism and animal use, you know? And, you know, you've got all this talent and stuff like that. And you know what? I honestly think that we're going to create there's going to be so many people promoting what we're promoting, and we won't need to really worry. You know, we just kind of just have to do it. I don't know how many of them are going to change, but I do feel like there's a lot of talent in there. You know, they have these great ideas and they have all these resources, and I'm like, you're already doing it. You're already educating the public. You're already out there talking about animals and you're already doing it. So how hard would it be now to just switch it to a bottom line consistent message, you know, and the more vegans that you create, you will have a vegan donor base, okay, who will give you money if you promote veganism.
Elizabeth, I understand your frustration, and I agree with you that, first of all, you said at the outset that you think that the abolitionist approach and what we're trying to do is very positive. And I agree with you. It's extremely
absolutely
positive. But to the extent that you get a negative reaction, you're getting it largely from people who, again, I can't emphasize this enough. What you're trying to do is change a business model when you are saying to animal advocates who are involved in these large groups, you really ought to change your position on this. It would be like going to Microsoft, telling Microsoft you really ought to be promoting Apple products. It's that simple. It's the same thing. You're telling them to sell. You're asking them to sell a different product. They're not going to. The organizations are not, unfortunately, going to do that because they understand well that the business model that works is a business model that makes people feel good morally without having to change their lives. I mean, look, Elizabeth, this is not just a problem with animal issues. It's a problem with human issues. So, you know, we who live in these, you know, wealthy countries that exploit the hell out of the rest of the world, you know, we'll see commercials at night that say, you know, give, you know, 10 cents a month to the, you know, child that this fund or that fund, and, you know, you can buy a pair of shoes for, you know, little Mary in Honduras or something like that. And people say, oh, yes, I'll send my 10 cents in and buy a pair of shoes for, you know, Mary in Honduras. And, you know, and I'll go and I'll mail the letter in my Hummer, you know, which is, you know, consuming, you know, 16 gallons of gasoline per mile. And while I, you know, and I'll continue to consume the way I'm consuming, I'll continue to support the exploitative policies that are ravaging other people in the world, poor people in the world. You know, this, there's a formula, there's a formula, and it's not that people are too stupid to understand the alternative. It's that the alternative really isn't presented to them either in the human rights context or in the animal rights context. When one of the things I find as a general matter is that, you know, I'm a relentless believer in the idea that people are at their core decent, good. They want, you know, I really believe that. And you know, I remember when I was a kid and when I was in high school, we had to read The Diary of Anne Frank. And that was the message that, you know, I mean, and it was, there was a profound, I mean, that was actually a real sort of shaping event in my life when I read that book, because here's this kid who's like, you know, a young kid, but obviously an old soul with great wisdom. And she, you know, she's living through and didn't live through, but she's living through the most, you know, arguably one of the most insane periods of human history, although there are many contenders, you know, is living through this incredibly insane time and in which she and everybody around her are threatened with death. And she looks at the situation and she says, at their core, people are really good, and I'm never going to give up, you know? And I think that that's a fundamental – that was a mind-blowing insight for me, you know, that this kid in the middle of the Holocaust can sort of look around the world and say, people are fundamentally good. And you know what? I think she was right. As a matter of fact, I know she was right. And so I do think – I mean, people can, for a variety of reasons, be easily distracted, Elizabeth. But that doesn't mean that they can't be educated and that they can't be brought out of their moral slumber, and that they want to be brought out of their moral slumber. And I think that people are hungry for that now, Elizabeth. And I think it's getting more. I think that's becoming more and more the case as people are becoming more and more alienated, and as they are seeing that materialism isn't making them happy, and that the things that they are being told 24 hours a day and all of the commercials and advertisements and the culture, that the things that they're being told are going to make them happy, those things aren't making them happy. We're seeing now an economic crisis. People are realizing that the material house of cards is about to fall. I honestly believe that in the midst of all of this chaos and craziness is a great opportunity. Is a great opportunity for sort of a real sort of moral revival around the notion of nonviolence and around the rejection of the sorts of things that we've been embracing for a long time now that we see aren't making us happy. And I think this idea that people are not going to accept it anyway is nonsense. If they aren't going to accept it anyway, then why bother talking to them about the idiotic things like cage-free eggs and single-issue campaigns and stuff like that? If they're not going to buy it, they're not going to buy it. Forget about it. I disagree with that. I think people will respond positively if the message is clear. And it's consistent. People will respond positively. I have that experience every day of my life. I know that you do a lot of tabling. I'm sure you have that experience, that people are – people become engaged. As a matter of fact, one of the interesting things is – one of the things I find is that to the extent that people react strongly when you start talking to them about the issue, those are almost always the people who are gettable and persuadable. If you stick with them, because the reason why they respond so strongly in the beginning is because you're resonating with them. You know, you're resonating with them. And some of the people who in my life, you know, have been the toughest in terms of people who have put up the most resistance, and people who have gotten angry, and people who haven't, you know, who have felt offended and haven't spoken to me for some periods of time, you know, will come back and say, you know, I've thought about it. And, you know, this is the reason why I was reacting, was that it troubled me. And I always say, yeah, I know. I understand that now. I mean, it's something that I have come to understand about the way these interactions unfold. You can almost always predict. Somebody comes up to you on the street, Elizabeth, when you're tabling. I mean, putting aside just the loudish people who come up to be abusive, but the people who come up and who are arguing with you in the most vociferous way, those are the people, if you stick with them, you'll get there.
I agree. I'm with you 100%. I'm with you. I am so right there with you. And, you know, I really hope that people listening get this. What I'm trying to do, one of the reasons why I asked you to come back on is not just because I just always want, you know, you to come on as a guest, but I really think that with this, we need to help people to understand that the positive movement for change and the abolitionist approach, the actions, it's the things that you are doing. And sometimes, because of the prevalence of welfare mindsets and things, it is the most challenging. It taxes the mind. You have to come up with so many different ways of addressing this thing. It's actually exciting if you want it to be exciting. I mean, some people are just looking for excitement. I love coming up with different ways. I love seeing the things that are working. And I know another one of your podcasts that you're going to do, which I'm really looking forward to, is you're going to talk to people around the world who are doing different sorts of nonviolent vegan advocacy, promoting abolition. And
yeah,
you're going to talk
there
about
there are a lot of folks. There are a
there
lot,
are
of,
a lot of people doing it. And, you know, it's a positive. It is the most, I got to tell you, one of the things that you talked about here was this, you know, this sort of negative, like giving up and people aren't good. That's what I thought. And the best thing that ever happened to me, the only thing that has kind of woken me up out of this, I was a very depressed. After 9/11, I went into a deep depression. When I saw the film Earthlings and I saw other videos of animal exploitation, which I'd never seen before, I was literally suicidal. And what has helped me the most is this positive movement for change that you basically started with your website, but that people are latching onto. And I'm one of those people. And I actually have, you know, this very positive, it's just amazing. And I talk to these people, like I talk to people on forums and things, and they're so negative and they've given up. And I'm like, don't, you know, don't give up. And I read what the other abolitionists are saying. And I'm like, can you not see this positive message in here? Now, a lot of what we're doing is education, because they're saying, why are you criticizing the groups? And I'm like, we want you to see this because you're supporting them and we need you. We need you, you know, like, please, you know, we help us. You're talented. You're bright. You care about animals. You're vegan. That's what I do to people. I'm like, we, you know, we're kind of in a way fighting for, you know, advocates in a way. Like, we want people to promote abolition. We want people to be vegan. And, you know, we're having to compete. And so in a way, it is vegan education. I believe that educating people about the absolute failure of welfare reform and the immorality of the promotion of it by these groups and career welfareists is part of vegan education. It's going to help our movement, and it's actually a positive thing. The truth is a positive thing. It hurts, but it's positive. So I want people to really think about that. It's not a goal. Like, yes, okay, you want abolition. Great. You're vegan. Great. How are you going to do it? You know, why don't you just think about what we're saying and read between, you know, the lines of this beautiful positive message of hope. I mean, abolitionists are the only people that I know that have absolute, you know, we know that people are fundamentally good, you know.
Well, unfortunately, because welfare is the default position, largely as a result of the fact that these large organizations promote it so vociferously. If you promote the abolitionist approach to the issue, you're almost always well, you're forced to spend a good deal of your time dealing with the welfarist position because it is the default position, which is part of the you know our present social paradigm and thinking about animal ethics. So, I mean, you know, the welfarists have done an excellent job of embedding this paradigm of humane use in you know, conventional thinking. So you've got to sort of dislodge that because that is the default position. But I agree with you. The message is very positive, the message of abolition is very positive. And one of the things that you know troubled me over the years is and you know you said something a minute ago that I find interesting because your perspective on it. Is interesting to me, and that is when you said that, well, the abolitionist approach started with my website. And actually, that's not true. The abolitionist approach started with my work in the early 90s. And what's interesting about it is because the animal movement, because before the internet, the animal movement basically the large groups controlled communication. They were unhappy with my critique of animal welfare, and they just erased my identity from their institutional memories. And I stopped being invited to conferences, which was all well and good because they were useless anyway. And these groups stopped promoting my work, and so the website. Is something that you know started in I guess 2006, but that's not the beginning of the abolitionist approach.
Oh,
the abolitionist
I feel approach so bad.
No, I don't want you. No, that wasn't. No. I thought you're right to say that the abolitionist approach started with the website in one sense, because it is true that. The movement around the abolitionist approach got started with the website, but the abolitionist approach itself was something that has been around, that basically I was developing in the early to mid 1990s. By the mid 1990s, it was basically pretty much fully developed, but was suppressed by the large animal organizations. So I think that I do agree with you that the abolitionist approach is a positive message, and I think that in the years that I was involved with the animal movement, I can tell you this: if I had 5 cents for every time I heard the expression in one form or another, I love animals, I hate humans, I would have been wealthy, because that is an expression I used to hear all the time, and I'm sure you hear it too. There's a certain misanthropic, the movement has a real misanthropic element and aspect to it. And there are some people who maintain that the animal rights movement is anti-human. At the base of it is a sort of a hatred of humanity. Now, I reject that in terms of what I believe is the real message of animal rights. I think that that's wrong, but I can see where people might come to that conclusion. I think a lot of those people come to the conclusion because they want to come to the conclusion. But I think that there are ways in which one can, as a sociological matter, look at the movement and quite legitimately infer that a lot of these people hate human beings, and I think that that's true. And I think that there's also a real misogynistic element to it. I mean, we live in a sexist, misogynistic society. So the fact that animal people, as a subset of that society, are misogynistic should come as no surprise. But I mean, I think that there are real problems in that regard. But I think in a lot of ways, if there's any, if the animal message is negative in any respect, it's the welfarist message that's really negative, because it's negative in so many ways. I mean, it's like people are dumb, people don't care, you know, people are horrible, they're never going to do anything. So, you know, let's just offer them little, you know, let's offer them padding on the waterboard. Maybe we can get them to do that and send us a donation. Let, you know, it's a very negative. And at its core, it's negative, because what it's basically doing is promoting the message. Whether they claim to want abolition as a long-term goal is irrelevant. What the message that they're promoting in the short term is happy meat, happy animal products. You want to talk about negative stuff? There's nothing more negative than tying some little, you know, festive bow you know, around animal exploitation and trying to make it look pretty. And that's negative. That's negative.
Exactly. And they're, you know, the people who are involved with this sort of way of thinking, the advocates themselves, they're despairing. They've given up. They have no hope. They say, what about the animals now? At least they have a couple more inches. And I really try to be, I can't be like that, because it doesn't help the animals to give up. I feel like it's a betrayal of them. You know, now that I've had this awakening in myself, I could never go backwards. And once you wake that part up in people, you see it everywhere. And I'm starting to see this kind of attitude. It's really, really shifting. The tide is turning. And, you know, people are starting to see the positive message that we're doing. And I think it's really important that you're addressing this. It's not just a goal. It's a way of getting there. I think that's so important that you started that dialogue with your last podcast, which is why I want to continue it with this one. And that you're going to move on to we've always been very proactive about how to talk to people. I can't wait for your next podcast, helping people with your experience, because like you say, not a lot of people are doing it yet or have been doing it as long as you. There are people out there who have been talking about veganism with people for a long time, and you're going to have them on your podcast and talk about their experiences. So that's all really very positive
Some of the people who are doing really interesting stuff are not people who've been doing it a long time. They're fairly young people. They may have been doing it for a few years, but that's nothing basically in terms of so they're fairly new to it, we had this workshop in May at Rutgers, but it was great because I'm trying to think back to who was there. I had not met any of those people before. I had communication with them obviously over the internet, but I had never met any of them personally before. And I was really just delighted with we had a room, we had a seminar room at Rutgers where we were doing this, and I can tell you that if you could attach wires to the room, you could have, you know, powered a good chunk of the level of energy. If you could attach wires to that room, you could have powered a good chunk of Manhattan with the energy. And they were all young people. They were all actually all younger than I was, which isn't hard. But they were for the most part really young people. And I was just amazed at the sorts of things that they were doing. And the energy that they had and the ideas that they had, and they were all they had different backgrounds, and they were working in different contexts, and you don't measure the strength of a movement by how many professional careerist advocates you have. As a matter of fact, you can measure the death of a movement by how many people are making a living from advocating the ideas. But these are people who, you know, you measure the strength of a movement based on, you know, people in their day-to-day, and how many people in their day-to-day lives are out there spreading this message in their day-to-day lives, in their local communities, in their local groups, in their schools and whatnot. And I was just delighted to sort of see what these people were thinking and how they were thinking it and how they were, you know, what they were doing and the sorts of things they were creating. It was wonderful. So, you know, I think that, I'm very, very optimistic. But look, There's one thing that I think, there's one idea that I think is very important that people really need to focus on. And that is, because this is a philosophical idea, but it's a philosophical idea that has, it's not just an abstract idea that, that is sort of sitting out there in the world of ideas and that doesn't have any practical impact. It's got a tremendous practical impact. And that is veganism a way of reducing suffering, or is it something more? And to the extent that you think of veganism only as a way of reducing suffering, then you see veganism as being really no different than other ways of reducing suffering. And so you say, well, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're vegan or whether you eat cage-free eggs or whether you promote bigger cages. It's all moving towards reducing suffering. And I think that's that reflects that idea, that notion reflects the welfarist view that animals don't care that we use them. They only care about how we use them. And that is an idea that is as old as animal welfare itself. I mean, you know, although there was no one person who was responsible for animal welfare, certainly a prominent person in the animal welfare movement of the 19th century was Jeremy Bentham, who was a utilitarian philosopher. Now, Bentham was the person who said, it doesn't matter whether they can talk or whether they can reason, but can they suffer? You know, and I think that was a very interesting observation he made about sentience being, you know, the perceptual awareness being the only characteristic you need to be a member of the moral community. But Bentham, who said the question is not can they talk, can they reason, but can they suffer? Bentham wasn't a vegan. He kept on eating animals. So the question is, why? Was Jeremy Bentham a complete hypocrite? And the answer is yes and no. I mean, in some senses, he was, I guess, hypocritical. But in another sense, he really did think that animals didn't care that we use them. They only cared about how we use them, because even though they're sentient, they're still different from us in that we're self-aware and they're not self-aware. So the cow doesn't care whether you eat her. She just cares about how you treat her and how you slaughter her. And that was what Bentham thought. And, you know, you can say, well, that's silly. And the answer is, well, maybe silly, but tell that to Peter Singer. Because that's exactly what Peter Singer says. I mean, with the exception of like the great apes and perhaps dolphins and things like that, where, you know, the special animals that Singer fetishizes and that other people fetishize, he basically thinks, you know, that chickens, for example, don't have a concept of their lives. So it's really not a tragedy that they're killed. It's a question about how they're treated and how they're killed. And that's why he talks about the luxury of eating meat from animals that have been raised in natural settings and killed in a relatively, you know, humane way, whatever, that there's nothing really wrong with that. That's why he talks about being a conscientious omnivore as a morally defensible position, because he shares Bentham's view and the welfarist principle that animals don't care about the fact that we use them. They only care about how we use them. So I think that we need to understand something, and that is, to the extent that we portray veganism as a matter of reducing suffering or as a matter of compassion the compassion that motivates us to reduce suffering, we're missing a big point, and that is veganism is not just about and I don't in any way denigrate the emotional reaction. I mean, I think it's a healthy reaction that, you know, when you see suffering, you want to alleviate it. I think that's a healthy reaction, and that's a good thing. But it goes beyond that. It's a fundamental matter of justice. So it's not just a matter of reducing the suffering of slavery. It's a question of abolishing slavery, you know, because the abolition of slavery is what justice requires. So veganism is not something, you know, it's not a lifestyle that reduces suffering. So it's a good thing because it's a lifestyle that reduces suffering. Veganism is what we owe to non-human animals as a fundamental matter of justice. And so I think that that's an important thing to focus on. I think that accounts a lot for, you know, the confusion among animal advocates, because when you said before, well, a lot of the animal advocates will, you know, promote veganism. That's true. They do, but they promote it as a sort of in a very loose way, as one of a number of things that in their judgment reduces suffering. which is why they see promoting veganism as consistent with promoting larger cages. Because
fact,
a lot of people say –
yeah, but in fact, sorry to interrupt, but in fact, they actually view it as less effective in reducing suffering. And I know this for a fact because they say, well, I can get 50 people to buy cage-free eggs, but I can only get one person to choose veganism or something like that. So it's more effective to promote this da-da-da-da. So they actually move it even lower down the reducing suffering chain. Then it certainly then it belongs, that's for sure. Because if you want to talk about eliminating all, you know, all participation and exploitation from a person's life, that's veganism. So not only do they view it as a reducing suffering method or just part of a bigger whole of reducing suffering, they review it as the least effective way.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's really interesting because you see on that trade-off, you know, I can get 50 people to go cage-free and I can only get one vegan. I'll take the one vegan over the 50.
Me too.
I mean, to me, my view is you give me a group of people who are willing to listen. And, you know, I'll get more, you know, in a fairly large group, I'll get more than one person to think seriously about and move toward veganism. But even if the choice were spending 2 hours of my time, I'm going to get 50 people to go cage free and I'm going to get one person to go vegan. To me, it is a no brainer that I would, it ain't even a question. I would go for the one vegan as opposed to the 50 people who are going to eat the cage-free eggs, because cage-free eggs are nothing but padded water boards, number one. And then what you end up with is 50 people who think that they're discharging their moral obligations to animals by eating cage-free eggs.
They're totally wrong about that. Even the reducing suffering thing, it's not even correct.
I agree, but I'm just saying this is why a lot of people say I don't understand why that animal advocates can on one hand promote veganism and on the other hand promote cage-free eggs. And the answer is, well, first of all, there's the business reason that it's economically better to get people to think that they're doing something morally significant while they're doing nothing, because that way you're praising them, they'll be happy that you're praising them, and they'll give you a donation. But there's also a philosophical element involved here, and that is basically the movement that we see today, the welfare movement we see today, is a movement that has brought into the notion promoted by Jeremy Bentham in the 19th century and promoted by Peter Singer in the 20th, that animals don't care about their lives. They don't care about the fact that we kill and, you know, that we kill them. They only care about how we treat them. And if that's really what you believe, then you do see this as a matter of reduction of suffering. Whether or not the welfarist things that you propose actually are reducing suffering, I think they're not, and I think the empirical evidence is pretty clear that they're not. But whether they are or they're not, that's how you're going to see the issue. You're going to see the issue as one of reducing suffering, and so you're going to see veganism as simply one way of reducing suffering. And as you quite correctly point out, you get these welfarists who say, you know, it's the least effective way of reducing suffering. No, I would suggest that if we had, you know, look, I still maintain, and I remember, you know, in the 1980s, I attended a meeting of animal rights leaders, the issue was supporting amendments to the Federal Animal Welfare Act in the United States, which is to call it a useless piece of legislation is to insult useless pieces of legislation. It's a really useless piece of legislation. And so they wanted it. The issue is, should the movement support amendments to the Animal Welfare Act? And of course, my view was no. And my view was that why don't we put all of our time and energy into vegan education? Because I was a vegan pretty early on in this, and let me tell you something. When I was first in the animal movement in the early 1980s, you could count on, you know, one hand the number of vegans out there, and you could chop off a few fingers and still have plenty of fingers left to count vegans. I mean, there weren't many, and so I was promoting veganism fairly early on, And I still maintain that if you took all the money that's been spent since the mid-80s, I mean, I wouldn't even want to think about how much money that is. It's probably in the billions. I mean, it's a huge amount of money. If you took the amount of money spent in the United States, Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the wealthier countries, if you took the money that has been spent on these idiotic animal welfare campaigns since 1985 and had put that money into vegan education, you would have many more vegans today. Veganism would be it would not be the stigmatized notion that it's been made to be, largely as a result of animal people and animal organizations. And you'd have a much larger number of vegans today, and you'd have the foundation of a real movement that was going to support meaningful change for animals. But what you have is zillions of dollars spent on campaigns for what? You know, I remember when I first got involved in this, a big issue was the anti-fur campaign. Talk about like useless. It's like now what, 2010, and the fur industry is incredibly strong. I mean, yes, it's been hit by the recession, so is everything. But before the recession hit, fur industry was stronger than it had ever been. So the idea that, you know, these campaigns simply don't work. They simply don't work. You know?
No, the proof is there. It's just the new people don't realize that. Like you said something, I think it was really great. You were talking about how the new vegans you've met, they're like, they don't know the history. They don't realize. They think this is all really new, innovative stuff that, you know, these groups are doing, and it's really going to change. It's really going to make a change, and they just don't realize that everybody's been chasing their tails for decades now.
It's like they say, you know, those who don't know history are condemned to repeat it. And so you have a lot of these young people coming into the movement, and you know, what are they confronted with? They're confronted with campaigns to get McDonald's to buy meat from slaughterhouses that have been approved by Temple Grandin. There's a good – let me tell you. You know the concept of animal rights doesn't have any meaning when somebody who designs slaughterhouses is called an animal rights advocate. I saw plenty of media coverage in which Temple Grandin was which two things were said. A, she was an animal rights advocate, and B, she had won an award from PETA. She did win an award from PETA, and the only question is whether you think PETA is an animal rights organization. I certainly have a view on that. But to the extent that you regard Temple Grandin as an animal rights advocate, you know that the concept of animal rights has become like totally meaningless. And so you have young people coming into the movement, and so what are they confronted with? What are they seeing? Well, they're saying, well, there's an anti-fur campaign, and there's this campaign, and there's the Happy Meat campaign, there's the Temple Grandin meat campaign, there's the gas chickens campaign, all this sort of stuff. And they say, oh, well, this is really progressive. And the answer is no, it's not. It's same old, same old, same old, same old. And, you know, and it's, you know, And if they bothered to sort of take a few minutes or, you know, a few hours or whatever and do some reading, they would see that these campaigns in various forms have been going on forever. And that, you know,
we're progressive. We're the progressive ones. Look over here, kids.
Yeah, exactly. But look, I mean, it's unfortunate that we have to spend our time engaged in dealing with a critique of the welfarist paradigm. I wish that wasn't the case. The problem is the welfarist paradigm is the default position. It's the default social position. And it will remain the default position until it is thoroughly critiqued and debunked. So it has to be critiqued and debunked. I frankly would find it more interesting to read a phone book actually than sort of continuing to talk about the problems of the welfarist paradigm. But the welfarist paradigm is the default position. You got to deal with it. But having said that, I agree with you that the abolitionist approach is the progressive approach. It's the positive approach. I mean, it's not a misanthropic position. It's a position which basically assumes that human beings are capable of making intelligent moral decisions and that they want to do so. And that, you know, the underlying notion of the abolitionist approach to animal rights is that people are basically good, and that they want to be good. They want to do the morally right thing. You know, they just need to be engaged about what that is.
I think that's just so important that people hear that, especially from you, because, you know, you're sort of the figurehead. You know what I'm saying? You can't avoid that fact. I think that the people in the movement are we do have to debunk the waffle. Once we get enough people, we won't even have to worry about them, because our voice will be just as strong, and we can do it. And, you know, we will have an equal voice, and they can't stop us, because, like you say, they can't suppress you anymore. They can't control the communication anymore. I wanted to just go back to one of the things you said about Jeremy Bentham, because what I would say is, like, even if it were true that animals didn't care that we used them and they only cared how we used them, it's still, in my opinion, you know, I don't believe that for a second, but let's say they're right. You know, one of the interesting things that happened to us the other day, I've had a little bit of a hiccup in my advocacy that I was doing, because they took my beautiful wall down and we didn't find out. We got to the stall. It was the first day without rain since I don't even know how many weeks it's been. And we get there and the wall's gone, and we just created this beautiful new sign, nowhere to put it. And we were like, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And so we wandered around and we found a marketplace. And they have tents and everything that you can hire, and it costs money and stuff. But we just said to him, I just spoke to the manager, and I was like, look, you know, can I just set up my table? He was totally clear. He said, well, what's it about? And I said, veganism. And he said, go ahead. So we set up our little table there. And
Who is this person who let you do this?
There's a street market in Auckland called the City Market. It's in a parking lot right by the Sky Tower.
And this person
the
runs
manager,
it?
The manager, he runs it. He runs it. And so we had a sign. We had our sign, and we had to choose. We're only able to have two signs, as opposed to the 20 that we could normally have, because one, we could only hang one from the front of the table. So I chose the one, violence is connected. Being nonviolent begins with you. You know, vegan. I can't remember the exact wording. And, you know, one of the funny things that this guy said was, he came over and he had a strong accent, and he looked at our sign, and we put on the other side, we put the one that says, got nonviolence, go vegan. That's from your website. And he looked at it and he said, and also you should mention that it's degrading. And William and I, his accent was really strong, and we thought he said decorating. So we were a little confused for a second, and he walked away. And what he said was degrading. And what he meant was, we're degrading ourselves by what we're doing to them. Like, you know, not acting violently, acting in an exploitative manner. And it is degrading what we're doing to ourselves as well as to them. And that's another way of, I find that, I don't quite know how to work that in, but it was amazing that this guy walked over and said it. Now, I didn't get a chance to ask him if he was vegan or what. You know, we get a lot of people coming up, Gary, who are like, yeah, woohoo, I'm vegetarian. Thinking that they're right there with us, you know, like we're all part of the same sort of team. And that's another thing that we're fighting against with regard to this welfarist stuff, is this huge celebration of vegetarianism. And you talk about dealing with the welfarist paradigm. The most difficult conversations I have with people are people who have bought into the happy meat thing. And they're sometimes the hardest people to convince about veganism than somebody who's never been talked to about animals at all. And people who have been convinced that vegetarianism is the same as vegan are sometimes the hardest people to even realize that there's a difference. So, you know, we have this huge educational thing against it, but I just thought it was interesting what this guy said, you know, and I'd never really thought about it that way before.
I think the thinking behind the Bentham position is that if in theory an animal doesn't care about continuing to live, I mean, which is a concept that I find so bizarre. The idea that you can be sentient, but not, I don't understand that. But the idea that an animal doesn't care about living, so that it's not harming the animal to kill the animal, which is really the position that Bentham and Singer are taking, is that because the animals are not self-aware in the same way we're you know, the humans are self-aware, or at least that, you know, normal humans of a certain age are self-aware, then they don't – it doesn't matter whether they live or die. What matters to them is whether they suffer. So if they don't suffer, you haven't harmed them by killing them. Now, I find that as a philosophical matter to be such a bizarre position to take. that I find it a rather bizarre position to think. However, even if I thought it were true, it would still be clear to me that there is no way to consume animals without some significant level of violence.
Yeah. Killing is violent.
But even if the animal doesn't care, even if the animal doesn't care that you kill the animal, even if she's indifferent to her life, so she basically doesn't really care. She's not harmed if you kill her, because that would be Singer's response to you, and that would be Bentham's response to you, is he would say, well, the animal's not harmed if we kill the animal, as long as we do it painlessly, then. The animal's not harmed. The animal's only harmed if we cause suffering or pain or distress or something like that, where there's a negative experience. If there's no negative experience, so in theory, the idea would be, well, if you had an animal and you treated the animal really, really well and never the animal never had a moment of suffering or pain or distress in her life, and then you killed her without suffering or pain or distress, then you wouldn't be harming her. That would be the now, again, I think that's crazy to say that killing is not a harm. In the same way that, look, obviously, if I, crept into your house while you were sleeping and I killed you while you were asleep so that you didn't know, that would be better than my torturing you to death. However, I would still be harming you. I'd be harming you in both cases. I would just be harming you, I'd be harming you. If I killed you, I'd be harming you. The very act of killing you would be harming you. And if I tortured you, that would be an additional harm. The view of the welfarist position, going back to the 19th century and continue, because I really believe, even though people don't talk about this explicitly, I really think this idea is pervasive. That is, this idea that it's not killing animals that's the problem, it's making them suffer, which is the problem.
You mean amongst the animal rights, quote,
yes,
unquote, community?
Yeah. I honestly think that these people have bought into this Bentham Singer idea.
Well, there's speciesism, in other words.
Of course there's – but you see, their response to that would be, no, we're not speciesist, because animals, as an empirical matter, as a factual matter, animals don't have an interest in continuing to live. So, I think it's speciesist because I think that it relies on a notion of self-awareness that begs the question. And it assumes what it's trying to prove. It just assumes it, that animals don't have an interest in life because they don't have an interest in life. Because we define an interest in life as basically excluding, their non-linguistic cognitions. So I do think it's speciesist, but they would say it's not speciesist at all. But I think that this is an important point. I mean, I don't want to bore people with philosophy, but this is an extremely important point. That is, you've got to understand where these people are coming from. You got to understand where Peter Singer's coming from. You got to understand I believe, for example, that acceptance of Singer's view is exactly what justifies, what Peter uses, whether they do it explicitly or implicitly, to justify the fact that they kill every animal that sort of walks through PETA's door. It's like, there's a needle waiting for you to every animal that walks through that door. Why is that? How could a, quote, animal rights organization take that position? Well, if you don't think that killing the animals are a harm, and you think, that is harming them, and you think that suffering is a harm, and you think that there's a remote possibility that if you adopt these animals out, they will suffer to some degree because people will not treat them as well as you want them to treat them or whatever. I don't know what goes on in their heads, but in Peter's heads, that is. But I believe that it is acceptance of the view that killing is not a harm that justifies, at least in Peter's mind, Peter's killing of healthy animals. So, I think this is a pervasive idea, and I think it's an idea. I think you got to understand something, and that is, this is a problem. A lot of really people who are as much as I hate to say this, people need to take a break from playing with computers, and they need to take a break from, you know, I mean, how many people sort of want to become animal advocates and they're not willing to spend the time that they need to spend to learn things? Because if you don't have you don't have to have a dense background in philosophy to understand and be a good animal advocate.
You just have to read your books. I read your books, and it was very clear to me. And believe me, my brain starts to sizzle and spark whenever there was any I hated my philosophy. It was interesting, but it did my head in. But your books are great for that. Anybody listening, read the books.
Well, I mean, the new one coming out, I hope people will like it.
Yeah, I want to talk about
it. I'm waiting. That should be out any day. I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, I should be getting the copies of that, and they should be getting to the bookstores any day. But it's called The Animal Rights Debate, and I wrote it with Robert Garner, who's a new welfarist supporter.
Yeah, I recognize his name from your other books, and I think it's very interesting that he agreed to write a book to do this with you. Now, that's a good thing on his part.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, Robert is an academic. You know, he works – you know, he's a professor at the University of Leicester in the United Kingdom. And
is he vegan, by the way?
Yes. Okay. And at least he says he is, and I believe him.
Okay.
And Robert, it's interesting because we have a very core, I mean, we have a very, even though we've criticized the hell out of each other over the years. And, you know, actually that's how the book came into being, was that, you know, he's been criticizing me forever. I've been criticizing him forever. So I called him up and I said, hey, Robert, you know, since we criticize each other all the time, why don't we do it to each other in the same book? You know, why don't we do the debate, you know, together rather than, you know, debating each other abstractly in our respective books? Why don't we, you know, have a go at each other in the same book? And he said, you know, that's a great idea. So we did the book together. And it's interesting because Robert is employed by a university. He is not a career animal advocate who works for an organization. So he was willing to do that. Now, it's interesting that the people who work for these organizations, they would rather die than debate. You know, it's funny. I got the other day I wrote to the CEO of an organization in Britain called Compassion and World Farming, which is a very welfarist organization that I think it's safe to say is completely a happy meat animal products organization.
Well, the title says it alone.
Yeah,
doesn't
yeah.
It?
And I don't, and I do not. I mean, and they're basically an organization that criticizes mildly, but nevertheless criticizes factory farming.
Yeah.
And but they don't promote vegetarianism or veganism or anything except bigger cages and this and that. And so I wrote to the CEO of Compassionate World Farming, and I said, I'd like to do a podcast debate with you. And he wrote back and he said, you know, I'm interested. What do you want to talk about? And then I wrote to him. I wrote him a rather long message, and I want to be upfront with people. I mean, I don't want to do any bait and switch. And I wrote him a lengthy email in which I said, on your website, you talk about your partnership with McDonald's and other corporations that exploit animals. And, you know, you talk about how, you know, you're working with them to make animal use better. And I think this is really counterproductive. And I sent him some things that I wrote. I said, here's my view. If you don't know my view already, although I have some good reason to believe the people in Compassionate World Farming know what my views are anyway. But I sent him some of the things that I've written, and I said, here are my views on this issue of animal advocacy groups forming partnerships with institutional users like this, because I think it perpetuates the notion of perpetuates animal exploitation because it makes the public feel more comfortable about it. And I said, that's what I'd like to talk with you about. I said we can discuss the broader philosophical issue of whether or not it's ever acceptable to use animals. I said, I'd be happy to discuss that with you. I said, but I said if you don't want to get into that, I said, then I'm more than happy to focus on the counterproductive aspects of the animal welfare paradigm and the fact that animal welfare reforms don't do anything anyway. And, you know, case in point, the European, you know, and I mentioned some of the European legislation with which he would obviously be familiar. Well, in lightning speed, I got a response back. Thank you very much for the invitation, but I'm too busy to do this. I was disappointed, obviously, but I wasn't surprised because, what are they going to say? To the point that animal welfare reform is ineffective. What the hell do you say to that? Oh no, we've got all these great victories. What are they?
Is he vegan?
I have no idea if he's vegan. I asked him that.
Because if he's not, then to me, that's the first thing you have to ask him. I mean, if he's not vegan.
But even if he wasn't, put aside whether he's vegan, put aside whether he believes in abolition. My guess is he's not vegan. I don't know. My strong suspicion is he doesn't support abolition as a long-term goal. But I don't know. But all I wanted to talk to him about is he's promoting certain welfare reforms. I'd like to know in what way he thinks they're effective. I'd like to know in what way he thinks they don't actually increase the production efficiency of animal exploitation because they make animal exploitation. I mean, you know, for example, you know, there's this campaign going on, and it has been going on for years now, about veal crates. Well, you know, the bottom line is, if you switch from veal crates to small social units, you reduce your veterinary costs considerably, and it's actually a much more economically efficient way of producing veal.
And they'll just change the marketing. If the flesh of the animals is slightly less, they'll just call it yellow veal or
yeah, exactly. They'll somehow make it an upscale. They'll keep it as an upscale product. They'll change the characterization and whatnot. But the bottom line is that a lot, you know, I cannot think of a welfare reform that isn't economically efficient, whether it's gassing chickens, whether it's veal crates, whether it's gestation crates. These are all things which actually increase production efficiency. That's what I wanted to talk to him about. I mean, if I'm wrong on that, I'd like somebody to discuss with me how it's wrong. You know, and I would also like to talk with him or any other defender of animal welfare in a position like that. How do you justify doing this when, in fact, I mean, you know, it's comical because if you go on the CIW, if you go on the Compassion and World Farming website, they have statements from these, you know, McDonald's and Unilever saying, oh, you know, we really value the expertise of Compassion and World Farming. You're helping us, you know, use animals better. These are wealthy zillion-dollar corporations. They don't need the expertise of Compassion and World Farming.
No, they need the marketing. They need
the marketing. And so what's happening is an organization like Compassion and World Farming or the Humane Society of the United States or RSPCA or, you know, the organizations that you have in New Zealand, these basically become PR organizations for institutional animal users, and they actually perpetuate animal use. Now, I you know, that's what I wanted to talk to him about. Whether he's vegan is a separate issue. Whether he believes philosophically that we should be using animals at all, that's a separate issue. I wanted to talk to him about what his organization is doing, and he wasn't willing to do it. And you know, he was too busy. You know, same thing. You know, I mean, same thing with HSUS. Same thing with, you know, with, I mean, you know, they're never gonna. You know, I'm happy. Ingrid Newkirk, Wayne Pacell. Pacell's the head of HSUS. These are people I know. In my early years in the movement, I worked with both of them. And I'm sure, you know, look. And I want to make one thing clear. You know, I'm not saying that they're bad people. I'm saying that, you know, they're part of something now. They're part of a big sort of corporate structure. They're now involved in multi-million dollar organizations, and they've now got, you know, vested interests in promoting certain things. And I think they both talked themselves into a lot of fantasy situations. You know, they've now talked themselves into the idea that animal welfare is going to lead us in the right direction. I think it's only leading us backward. I think the empirical evidence is clear that it's only leading us backward. And I think what it's doing is perpetuating the exploitation of animals. And the bottom line is per capita consumption of animal products is going up. And the response to that, these animal people, is, well, it might even be more if we weren't doing what we were doing, is a pretty weak response. It's a very weak response. It's funny. It's like when I some months ago, I said something about how fur was the really paradigmatic single issue campaign, and the fact that the fur campaign had been such an abysmal failure was really proof that these single issue campaigns can't work. And the response was, well, women would be wearing more fur if we didn't have, you know, all this anti-fur activity. Well, that's really pretty weak, right? I mean, when the fur industry is stronger than it's ever been after decades of campaigning. And the best you could say is, well, it might be stronger. Well, you know, that is such a weak response.
And I can vouch for this because when I am talking to people walking down the street, all I hear is this, oh, but I only buy free range, so I'm way better than, oh no, I'm vegetarian, so I'm right there with you. Oh no, I don't support factory farming. I agree with this. No, I don't. I think animals should be treated way better than we treat them. And you have to sort of really fight against that. And they've just come from another stall, maybe, where the biggest, most famous animal group has just given them a great big thumbs up for that. And then they come along and there's me, and they're kind of like, well, you know, they told me it was okay, so who are you? And so, you know, but the thing is, it's easy to talk to people because, like you say, you just challenge the mind, and it is amazing discussions happen. I thoroughly enjoy doing it, and it just gives me an incredible amount of positive energy to do it. So I don't know where people are getting the idea that it's impossible, you know, they haven't tried it. I dare people to try it. And it means not just one time, it means every single time.
And it means, you know, and it also, and you know, I'm going to follow up on this in the podcast I do about talking to non-vegans. But, you know, when you talk to people and you're trying to persuade them of something, you know, the prescription for disaster is if they get the view that you're starting off the conversation thinking that they're moral eunuchs, they're not going to really be particularly amenable to what you have to say. And so I think you have to be really engaged with people.
Yeah, I need some help with that because sometimes I say the wrong thing and people say, you're calling me a rapist. And I'm like, oh no.
Yeah, I mean, I'll address this when I do the podcast at length. But, you know, yeah, I do think that animal exploitation is like human exploitation. But I think we've got to be very, very careful. Yes, animal exploitation is morally unjustifiable in the same way that violations of human rights like rape and pedophilia and other sorts of things and slavery are violations. That doesn't mean that people who exploit animals have the same intentions. And for me, morality is a matter of intention, and largely.
Oh, thank you. That's fantastic. I'm going to. Oh, see, you need to do this podcast. You need to do it this weekend.
Yeah, I mean, it's largely a matter of intention, and so therefore, you know, when I'm talking to a person, they generally are people who are, you know, people who consume animals in various ways. And I don't think what they do is morally justifiable. And I do think that the practices of using animals our institutionalized exploitation of animals is similar to our institutionalized exploitation of children, women, you know, whatever. But that doesn't mean that when you're talking to a person who eats animal products, you're talking to a person who has the same moral status in terms of her intentions as a child molester. And so if you start, you know, I've had people come up to me and say, you know, are you saying that, you know, I mean, I read something you wrote. Are you saying I'm just like a child molester? And I say, well, why do you think I said that? Well, because you said, you know, that exploiting animals is like pedophilia or like rape. You know, I say, well, it's like it. It's like it in the sense that you're exploiting vulnerable beings and you're violating their fundamental interests in various ways. Yeah, it's similar as a practice. I said, but you know, I Did I call you a pedophile? Did I call you a rapist? Did I call anybody a rapist or a pedophile? And then – so I think, you know, you involve them in a discussion about how morality is a matter of intention, that people really do sort of need to educate themselves. I mean, in a society in which animal exploitation is the default position and is pervasive, you've got to give people the benefit of the doubt and educate them. You know, and at some point – their moral status may be a problem, in the sense that they might accept all of the predicate facts and premises that are necessary and still say, what troubles me is when someone says, I agree with everything you're saying and I don't care.
Yeah, that doesn't happen very often, though.
Yeah, exactly. I agree with you. That does not happen very often. I mean, occasionally it happens, and even when that happens,
could just be a defense or,
yes,
you know.
Exactly. That's my initial impression. When somebody says something like that, my initial impression is to say, all right, well, that's probably a defensive reaction, because I can't really believe that this person, you know, believes that. But you know, so I think that when you talk to people, it's really very, very important to engage them. And you can't engage them if they think you're making, you know, moral judgments about them, as opposed – so I think you've got to really make it clear from the beginning. You're not making a moral judgment about them. You're making a moral judgment about a practice, and that they engage in that practice, and maybe they haven't thought about it. And what you want to do is get them to think about a practice they're participating in that they haven't recognized raises moral issues. And so that's how I think it's much better to approach them.
Wonderful. This is fantastic. You've just helped me so much. I mean, I just am like, thank you.
No, it's a simple idea, Elizabeth, but if you think about it, it's really the right way to sort of go about this, because, you know, no one's going to listen to you if basically, you know, you walk up to somebody and say, you know, I think you're a creep. Now I'd like to talk with you about something. They're not going to really be.
Well, disposed. I don't say that, but I have had an experience.
But you gotta, you have to be careful that they don't hear it that way.
Yeah, that's the problem, you see. This is really, really, you got to really go over this one. Can I make a personal request for your next podcast, that you really, what you've just said now, and elaborate on it about the analogies that we use. I know advocates who hesitate to use the analogies. I know advocates who've been offended because they have been victims of these real crimes on their own persons, and say it's the wrong approach and stuff like that. So I think this is a really important thing that you are talking about now, and that you should definitely help. That, you know, even just what you said now is going to help me so much when I next, because I don't use them as much anymore, because I've had a negative reaction. I haven't been using them. I'm talking like face to face with people in the street.
Yeah. No, I think it's always important, and sometimes you have to even be explicit and say to them, I am not talking about judging you. I'm talking about moral actions, and I'm talking about the moral status of certain things that we do. And you might participate in those things, and you may never have thought about it as a moral issue, and that's what I'm asking you to do. I'm not condemning you. This is not a matter of moral judgment. This is not a matter of judging matter. This is a matter of analysis, and I'm asking you to take a little journey with me through our moral thinking. And how you decide to come out is your decision. But what I want you to do is take a moral journey with me. And I actually use that expression. I said, you know, let's just take a moral journey together and think about these ideas. Maybe you've never thought about them before, and that's what I'm asking you to do, is think about them. That's all I'm asking you to do, is think about them. And the other thing is, you got to be really patient with people, because, look, I know a lot of advocates get very, very impatient about the questions that they get asked and stuff. Bottom line is, there is nobody in the universe who has been asked more of these questions than I have over the years. I mean, you know, sometimes I think that my head's going to explode if somebody asks me again, what about plants? But, you know, I got it. You know, 2 days ago. I mean, I get it all the time. I mean, I get the plant question all of the time. And I got, you know, I can dismiss it and say, you know, that's a stupid question, or I can engage it. And if I engage, you know, I mean, what I find is that people who engage you on, you know, it's the people who walk away who aren't interested, you know, then you there's really nothing to say. But people who engage you, unless it's really, really just abusive, loudish behavior, people who engage you are interested. Take advantage of that. They're giving you a green light. Drive, you know, and drive. Go. you know?
Hey, I just want to – can I just make one more point, though?
Sure.
I'd like your thoughts on this. Going back to the analogies that we use, one of the things that I realized that may be a problem with that is if you use those analogies and you're talking to a human being that you don't know very well and they have been a victim, they have been a victim of something that you're using, and it may bring up extremely hostile, negative, and depressing imagery in their mind. And that's another reason why I'm a little bit hesitant to go there, because you don't know what's happened to these people. They're complete strangers. They may have been raped. They may have been victims of child molestation. I do not want to trigger some kind of crisis in them. And I just – that's one thing that I've – I'm also trying to be careful of.
Well, sure, and I think that's important, which is why, you know, although I do use those analogies, I don't. They're not sort of out of the. I don't pull them out right up front. I mean, there are situations in which they will come up fairly quickly in a conversation, but as a general matter, they don't, and I don't raise them until the person I'm speaking with understands a little bit more about the conceptual background of what I'm talking about. So I will, you know, to the extent that that comes in, it will come in when somebody asks me a question, but, you know, isn't it better for us to, you know, have campaigns for humane use? And then I might say something like, look, do you think slavery is wrong? And they'll say, you know, absolutely. Well, should we, in response to slavery when we find it, should we have campaigns for humane slavery? Should we have campaigns for humane torture of political
prisoners? Yeah, I think torture is a good one. And I also just sometimes just say human rights violations, because that's the whole gamut. And you don't actually have to specify anything, but they still get it. They say,
well, you
right.
can't. You have to be careful about that, though, because there can be some human rights situations in which incremental reforms make sense. The problem is that incremental reforms don't really make sense in a context of where you're dealing with non-persons. In other words, you don't incrementally create personhood. Once you have personhood, you might incrementally improve the treatment of persons, but you don't incrementally get to personhood status.
That's so important. That's so important that a lot of people also don't realize. That's just so incredibly important a concept. You know, we need those basic right. One of the things, and you mentioned a guy in your book, and I've never heard of him, but it's somebody Shu, and he talks about basic, you know,
right.
The basic right. That helped me a lot. People are missing that point really hugely.
It's absolutely right. I mean, you don't incrementally eradicate the status of slavery. So talking about humane slavery is ridiculous. Once you get rid of slavery, you can have things which eradicate discrimination, but you don't have incremental things which eradicate slavery. Similarly, you know, and so I think certain human rights violations, like slavery, like torture, like rape, you know, which is basically a negation of the personhood status of one of the many zillions of reasons why rape is so objectionable, is because it basically depersonizes the victim, because she then becomes exclusively a means to an end, and she is treated solely as a resource, and that's one of the many reasons why. I mean, it really is. All batteries are terrible things. When you batter a person, it's a terrible thing. They're all violent. But rape is one of the many reasons why rape is a particularly odious form of battery, is because it really does depersonize the victim. And you know, I had a very tense discussion once with somebody. I was giving a lecture at a university on this topic, and I used the analogy in the discussion. And somebody came up to me afterwards and said, you know, I was a rape victim. And I said, I'm very sorry to hear that. And she said, I was really offended by what you said. And I said, well, why were you offended? I said, I'm really sorry that you were a rape victim. I said, but why were you offended by what I said? And she said, well, because she said, I was trivializing my experience to compare what happens to an animal to what happened to me. And I said, yeah, but don't you see? I said, I understand why you're saying that, and I understand your perspective. I said, but just take a step back if you can. And maybe you can't. I said, but just take a step back if you can. And think about what you just said. What you basically said was you had this really horrible experience, and you object to the fact that that I'm saying that in one sense, not in every sense, but in one sense, it is the same sort of experience that animals have in terms of their being, their personhood being completely negated, and they're being treated exclusively as a resource. That is really that's very similar. And we had a discussion. We talked about that for probably an hour after my lecture ended, and just she and I alone talking about this. She corresponds with me to this day. And we actually she's now a vegan, I don't know. I can't say that she uses that analogy when she talks about veganism, but she certainly understands why I do, and she's no longer offended by it. Look, whenever you're talking about moral issues, Elizabeth, one thing I've learned is that whenever you're talking about moral issues, you're always inevitably you don't change people's fundamental ways of thinking without on some level upsetting them and the sort of the things that they regard as comfortable. I understand that, a rape victim might object to the analogy, but I think if we make clear what the analogy is intended to do is to point out that there are certain forms of human exploitation that completely depersonize the moral person and treat that person as a thing. And that is exactly what we do with animals. We treat them as things. They're not regarded as members of the moral community in any sense whatsoever. They're regarded as things. And so when you thingify something, talking about humane thingification is sort of dumb. And whether that's in a rape context or whether it's in an animal context or whether it's in a pedophile context, it doesn't really matter. You're treating a person as a thing. And talking about, same thing with torture. So therefore to talk about, the humane treatment of the thing doesn't really make any sense. It really doesn't make any sense at all. And it's not what we would do in the human context. And again, I've been finding recently, because we all talk of waterboarding, it's really a great metaphor.
It's a good one. Yeah,
it is. I mean, you just say, hey, look, are you, if you think human rights are really in a dismal state, join with me today. I'm going to, as a matter of fact, I was actually thinking of forming, organization for water, for padded.
You would not.
An organization for padded waterboards as a sort of a satire on the whole animal movement, because that's really what the modern animal movement is. Is the same as the movement for padded waterboards. And just as we would find it to be absurd in the human rights context, we ought to find it absurd in the animal context.
I do, and many more people do, Gary. I know that I've taken up 2 hours of your time, so before I let you go, I just want to say again that I'm really trying to one of the things I was trying to do about engaging with you on these types of things is to see that so that people can see, because somebody said something that really resonated with me. He said, let's show them what we're creating and not just what we're by using the word, we're actually, it is a form of creation because we want to create this new wonderful world. And I think that's a wonderful way of doing it. So when people object to the sort of what they see as always a stop, 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 because a lot of people, they don't like to be told to stop doing something. But as opposed to that, creating something, help us create this new. Don't you want to create a peaceful world for your children? Don't you want to create a sense of peace inside yourself? Don't you want to create a world in which we do not torture other beings? I think that's also a good way of doing it. Some people do respond to the stop, this, abolish this, but I think that it can go both ways, and what we're doing is an incredibly positive thing, and I'm very grateful to be a part of it.
Well, look, I think of the abolitionist approach to animal rights as very creative in the sense that it's trying to create a new vision of nonviolence and it's trying to create a new peace movement, actually. That's what I see it as. I mean, I see it as sort of trying to create a new peace movement, trying to expand the concept of nonviolence in ways that will enrich the experience of all of us. I mean, look, violence is a really ugly thing, and violence never solves any problems. It only creates more problems. And the world is a really violent place, and it's been violent for a long time. So if violence was ever going to get us anywhere, we wouldn't have the level of violence we have now. And what the modern world is proof positive of the proposition that violence only begets violence. We've had violence for such a long time. Violence is the default. It's the, you know, it's the macho patriarchal way of dealing with every conflict is force, kill, you know, it's that sort of thing. And that's got to, you know, that is not getting us anywhere fast. As a matter of fact, it's getting us into deeper and deeper trouble. And so I think of it as a very positive thing. And I want to thank you for having me. I know that a lot of people listen to your podcast. I hope that they will benefit from this, learn something from it. And I'll be doing the podcast about talking to non-vegans, in which we'll be going over some of these ideas. And I want to thank you for having me. When the book comes out, I will make sure that Columbia University Press, which is publishing it, and you see, and there's another differentiation. My books are not self-published. They're actually published by presses, unlike these animal rights books, which are sort of, you know, printed by, you know, they're self-published books that are produced and distributed and are long extended pamphlets supporting these various animal corporations. But anyway, I'll have Columbia Press send you a copy of the book. You can then do a podcast review of it.
Absolutely. And I'm going to be passing it around.
Okay. Take care.
Thank you so much, Gary. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you very much.